Hi, today is January 16, 2016. This is Mobile Views Podcast. It was originally going to be 144 part two because I recorded part one last night with my friend Andy, who talked about the NFC chip, which you've probably already listened to. Or it's Mobile Views Podcast 145. We'll figure it out later when I publish it and post it up and label everything. But in any case, I am Tadao Gasawara. And as usual, my good friend John Westfall, who could not make it to our podcast with Andy because, quite frankly, it was like 1 a.m. in the morning. It started 1 a.m.
Yeah, it was one of those crazy things of trying to coordinate multiple time zones, and I was caught in the middle.
Literally.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for folks who, I think I may have mentioned it during the podcast with Andy, but Andy is in Stockholm, Sweden, which is GMT plus one. I am in Honolulu, Hawaii, which is GMT minus 10. And John is somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. And so it was 9 p.m. my time. It was 8 a.m. Saturday morning, Andy's time. And it worked out fine for us, but John needs sleep.
Yeah, sometimes. Not always.
Yeah, and the birds, you know, too. The birds would have been irritated if you were talking in the night.
Yeah, they would have been. They kind of put up with my shenanigans at night, even though they don't think they should be up.
Okay. All righty. So the first thing in our list, nothing really big in our list, I think, although I do have a little mini, maybe not a rant, but an objection. First thing I wanted to mention is I think something that John and I both like, and that's the R project, open mm-hmm. source statistical language / package. Microsoft bought a commercial version of it. The name of the company is Revolution. A while back, I can't remember, maybe a year ago, maybe a little more. But in any case, they released something called Microsoft R Open this past week. It was formerly known as Revolution R Open. Before the, you know, Microsoft bought the company, and they call it a free enhanced R for Windows, OS 10, and Linux. It's free to use and share. Now you might wonder, why would I need this if R is already free and open source in its original form? Microsoft has a couple. There's a link that Microsoft has on their R Open page that lists the number of enhancements they make to the package, which is available across platforms. So it's, you don't have to use Windows to use Microsoft's enhanced version of R Open. I'm going to download it just to see what it looks like because I'm a fan of R. John, I don't know, you going to take a look at it? It runs on OS X.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I would need any of the
enhancements.
Any of the improvements or enhancements that they've made. I might take a look. I might actually just do the lazy man's take a look, see what you say about it, and then go off of that. But it is interesting to see R evolving. Anything that raises the, I guess, profile of R is something I'm happy about, just because
too.
I'm very annoyed with the previous available options for my students when it comes to statistics.
Yeah, I know what you mean, you know, but I don't really know what the kids use these days, but in the old days, you know, decades ago, you know, SAS, SPSS, BMDP, some of them are probably gone by now, but those are very, I guess it was expensive packages. I think there were a couple hundred dollars for students to buy them.
Oh, yeah.
PCs.
And SPSS, for what SPSS does, I'm very annoyed with the price level that it has for students, just because when teaching introductory stats course, it's very frustrating to want your students to be able to do things in depth, and they have to find a computer lab computer to do them.
Yeah. Well, you know, just give them a pack of Hollerith cards and a card reader and send them off to a mainframe somewhere. They'll teach them.
Yeah, that'll be great. I would suspect that not a single one of my students would be able to figure out anything about that if I were to ask them to do that.
You know, I think that's personally, I think from a historical point of view, it would probably, you probably can't find a card reader or cards for that matter anymore. But it would be kind of a fun little project to, you know, make intro students do it at one time, you know, kind of a 1 week thing. See how, you know, the ancients did it. You know, kind of like building the pyramid kind of thing. My gosh, they did all this with cards? It's amazing. But in any case.
I like how you've upgraded, you know, the ancients to that lofty term.
Well, you know, I'm one of the ancients, so I wanted a nice term. Okay, next up, another Microsoft item. This one, I don't know, I really want to hear your opinion on this. So this has been in the news for a couple, maybe 6 months now, Microsoft iOS Bridge to Windows 10. And so the idea is it is not an emulator. You know, you don't simply grab an iOS app and stuff it onto a Windows box and let it run. Basically, it's a Objective-C environment for Visual Studio that helps iOS developers recompile, rebuild their iOS apps for Windows 10 and presumably Windows 10 Mobile. You know, if they had done this 7 years ago, it might have made some sense. But today, I don't know. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I don't really know if you want for your platform to basically build your argument being you can just reuse your stuff from another platform right. and you'll be fine. That doesn't seem to have ever worked out well in any other device that I've seen that's been attempted where we've told people basically just write the same app. Some of the cross-platform products, sort of the web app solutions for these things always turn out to be less than, you know, performance-wise of a native app. So I don't know if we really want to start telling developers, hey, come here and develop for Windows 10 universal apps, and it'll be just as easy as developing your iOS apps.
Right.
That, and my second concern is, if I'm an iOS developer, and I'm if I was going to add another thing that I'm not. If I was an iOS developer and reasonably successful, which I cannot attribute to myself, I don't know if I would take the gamble of Windows 10. Because I've seen Microsoft over the last 5 years change directions 3 or 4 times. I've seen them basically double down all in on universal apps with Windows 8 and then basically back off of that with Windows 10 saying, yeah, we won't make you always use universal apps. The desktop will still be more prominent. The start menu will come back. So I don't know what I would think if it would be worth my time to devote my resources to developing for Windows 10 if I'm already an iOS developer and doing pretty well there. I might just say let Windows developers develop something similar to my product unless I think I'm going to grab a lot more people.
Mm. Right, and the idea is that it's Windows 10, not just Windows 10 Mobile. So in theory, at least, you could move your app to the desktop notebook kind of environment using Bridge. But I agree with you completely. And quite frankly, I was gonna do a mock chiding of you saying, what? You don't believe this will last? I mean, didn't you believe in ActiveX and Silverlight?
Yeah, that does sound like me.
But I agree. It's if you are making a good living doing iOS apps, which, you know, is not a big market, right? It's, what, 25, 28% of the mobile market. Android has the rest. But you can still make a good living if you're a successful iOS developer.
Yeah, because you're charging much more than you would on Android.
Yeah,
so
which is usually free.
You don't need as much of a presence there to make the same amount of money.
Right, especially if you have the app add-ins, you know, which apparently can make tons of money, especially in the game area where people spend hundreds of dollars to, you know, put a little castle up or something on their screen.
A little castle, a little, you know, moat, whatever you're going to
play. That's right. That's right. That sounds appealing right now. I should go find such a game. But yeah, I agree. I don't think this is going to do much. They're also working on something, I forget the code name, that does the same thing for Android apps. Android developers, I don't know, they might find it interesting. They might find it more interesting than iOS developers, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to see. Let's see what happens with this. I don't have high hopes for it, yeah. But...
But that said, you know, I can't remember the last time I downloaded a modern UI app on my Windows 10 box. And I use Windows 10 every day. So this is, you know, that's something that I just use, you know, once a week or something. So I am not in a market for Windows 10 app. I really don't care. I just want stuff to run on my desktop like it always has.
Yeah, and that's a kind of a scary thing that even... I don't think Microsoft's figured out yet, and that is the stalwart Windows users don't want modern apps. They like their original apps. So you're going after a market
that doesn't exist.
That doesn't exist. I want something that's a modern app on the large screen. Why wouldn't I go with iOS, where every app under the sun is there? Well, I really want to run Windows. But if I really want to run Windows, I want to run Windows apps. Yes. I don't want to run modern apps.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a market that isn't there.
Indeed. Okay, next one is leaving Microsoft's domain and going over to the other big boy, Google. So Google, I read in VentureBeat that Google is releasing, or has released, actually I think I've got the update. Google Maps for Android has a new inference mode that tries to guess or infer where you're going to next. Now I took a look at it on my phone. So I updated the Maps app the other day, I think I finally got it. And it does look like when you open it, that it looks at two things, really, your Google search history. So if you've looked for places, it assumes that you're interested in going there, sometimes incorrectly. And it also looks at places you've been. So in my case, it says, hey, you know, you've been to the airport recently. You've been to the veterinarian recently. You visited your mom recently. So it made some pretty good guesses. You know, I was in my office, so it made some pretty good guesses based on where I actually went to, but did not necessarily search for. You know, I know how to get to my mom's house.
Mm-hmm.
Some people might find it creepy. I find it kind of useful, potentially useful at least. But
I mean, this is kind of what Apple's been doing on iOS for the last year or two, where, you know, you get this pop up every so often that says, hey, if you want to get to blank, it'll take you X amount of minutes right now.
I haven't seen that.
Oh, yeah. I get those fairly often on mine.
And that's from what app on what?
It's just Apple Maps.
No kidding.
So Apple Maps will pop up, like it knows I go to work every morning sometime between 7:40 and 8 o'clock, so it'll give me a little pop-up some mornings. I've never been able to figure out how to get it to reliably work. That's the weird thing.
Maybe I have I was just wondering if I have notifications on my iPhone turned off, because I've never seen that.
Well, and the other thing that's really kind of funny with it is the when I'm traveling up in Ohio, it knows that I generally hit three or four spots where I'll go from my parents' house to my in-laws' house to the city that I went to high school in. And, you know, all three of those are kind of like common stops for me. So at times, if I'm, say, down in Pittsburgh area, I will get this pop-up that says something like, it takes 4 hours to get to... You know, Marblehead at this point.
Ohio.
Yeah, in Ohio. And like, yeah, I must have at some point in the past enough times driven from Pittsburgh to there, and it figures that when I'm out, that's a possible place I'll go. And sometimes it's actually right. That is where I'm heading. So, but it's kind of an interesting feature. You can drill down in iOS privacy settings. I'll see if I can find it just off the top of my head here. So I think it's under settings, privacy, location services, and then somewhere around here, it actually tells you where it thinks you go very often. And you can tell it not to do that anymore because it's kind of creepy if you don't like it. The other interesting thing about that is also if you do things that are temporary, it might think that you're actually doing them permanently. So I remember last March, April, we were dog sitting every couple of weekends. And so at one point, it just kind of kept telling me, hey, it's time to go over, you know, to your friend's house and, you know, it'll take 10 minutes to go over there and let the dogs out. It was, kind of creepy, but I guess ultimately useful. I mean, I like the idea of the phone trying to use all the data it's collecting anyway to help me figure out, you know, give me useful information like that. But yeah. You're just, it just doesn't know you well enough, Todd. That's why it hasn't told you any of this stuff.
Interesting. I check now. All right.
Oh, yeah, I found it. So if it's under settings, okay, here's the whole thing. Settings, general, privacy. Oh, no, it's not under general, just settings, privacy. Location services. Then system services. Then
that's pretty deep.
Just had it, yeah. Frequent locations. And so when I go in there, it's got that there are 10 frequent locations around my home area here in Mississippi. So one of them is my office, one of them is my home, one of them is a restaurant I go to fairly often, a couple of restaurants I go to fairly often are in there. And then if I go to, there's a friend's house in Indiana, there's some locations in Pennsylvania. So I will kind of, so that you can see it, that's what I have on mine. And if I drill in where there's multiple locations, this is wonderful for an audio podcast, it'll actually show me the multiple locations it knows that I go to frequently.
I got to look at that on my phone.
Yeah.
I will do so. Okay. Now, leaving that, since we didn't rant about it, I think we both like the idea of Google Maps kind of inferring from our past movements what our future movements might be.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, it's a cool idea.
Yeah. There was an article in USA Today titled, Why That Fitbit Might Not Be So Good For You. And not to defend Fitbit, I don't think they need any defense, although I think after their introduction of their new watch, their stock tumbled along with the rest of the world. So maybe it wasn't just their new watch. But, you know, I've been using a Fitbit since May 2010, so we're coming up on 6 years pretty soon.
You've been Fitbitting for a while, and I've been using one on and off for just about as long.
So. And, you know, so they say that if it feels like if getting to your steps feels like work, then it's not good for you. I'm not so sure that's true. I mean, I certainly don't feel like it's work to get to my – and, you know, some days I don't. Generally Sunday I don't hit my 10,000-step quota because that's kind of the day I don't like to do 10,000 steps or more. But I never feel like, oh – you know, I have to do this. No, it's just during the course of my day, I just tend to walk 10,000 steps. There are some days when I hit 9,500, and I say, oh, well, I just need to take 500 steps, and I'll walk around the home or something just to get to 10,000. But I don't feel compelled to do it, and I'm not sure if it would be bad if I did feel compelled to do it. You know, it's probably a healthy kind of compulsion.
Yeah, I mean, what's the problem? That people are going to be going out there and walking around more than they otherwise would? I mean, that does seem like a really strange sort of worry that they're having for us.
Yeah. Yeah, and so in the, like I said, in nearly 6 years I've had it, 5 years, what is it, 8 months or whatever it is, I think the word is enjoy. I've enjoyed knowing how many steps I take each day. Yeah, it is disappointing some days when I before I turn in to sleep, I say, oh, I only hit 9,200 or whatever, or less. You know, I only hit 7,000, or if I'm sick, you know, it's been like 2,000. If I have a cold or a flu or something, but it's been interesting. I find it fascinating to look at my lifetime stats. I think I passed 20 some odd million total steps the other day, and I don't know how many thousands of floors climbed, but
since you've been counting.
Yeah. So
presumably you did much more of that in your previous years before you got a Fitbit.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's kind of funny because I was thinking, well, this is a while back. I was thinking, is it possible to hit 100 million steps before I die? And I did kind of a back of a paper napkin calculations, you know, assuming you slow down and all that as you get older. And the answer is no, I'm not going to make it. So that's the only disappointing thing I have. I'm pretty sure I'm not going to hit 100 million steps before I die. So that's a little disappointing.
But did you project backwards on how many steps you already had before you got your Fitbit?
No, I didn't. I did not.
I mean, that seems like that would make you feel a little bit better, and that I'm sure that you've got some banked millions of steps.
Yeah, I've been trying to convince my daughter is very active to wear a Fitbit, but she just won't do it.
It is interesting. I did run a study last fall at Delta State, where I'm a professor, and we did strap Fitbits onto students. And while I'm still waiting on a colleague to get me kind of the results of the hypothesis we had, talking to students about kind of their reactions to it, and some of them very much enjoyed it. Others were not very happy about it just because it kind of held up a light to how little bit of activity they were getting.
It gave them negative information.
Yeah. So it's definitely, you know, I use it basically, I was thinking about this because I've taken mine off and on over the last few years. I've been wearing one now for about, I guess, 4 months, 5 months. And I've realized that I don't look at the stats that often. I think the thing I get the most use out of now is knowing how long I slept the previous night and knowing what time it is. If I get up in the middle of the night and I just want to check the time, I can use the Fitbit One, cycle through and find what time it is right now.
Which Fitbit device are you using?
The One.
Oh, the One. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is the one I use also.
Yeah, so that's kind of where I'm useful. And I don't even look up the sleep stats in the app. It's just basically in the mornings when I turn off the sleep going, oh, that was how long I was asleep or something like that. So
right. And if you actually do look at the stats, it tells you how many times you awoke, if any, during the night, or what it thinks it considers being awake, and how many times you're restless. So it's interesting. You know, I've noticed that when I have a cold or something, you know, I get up a lot more. I'm a lot more restless when I sleep. So I think it's pretty accurate. Any case, and not exactly a rant, I guess, but maybe a disagreement on what, you know, I don't know if I would say the Fitbit is good for you, but I don't think it's bad for you, certainly. And it's not a bad thing to know that, you didn't quite hit your quota. Maybe you'll try a little harder next day or next couple of days.
Maybe. But in reality, you probably won't.
Okay. Now, as you know, probably one of the favorite things of mine that I bought last year in 2015 was the Amazon Echo. Having resisted buying it for a long time, it finally had a sale day, I think back in October, November. So, you know, last year, 2015, the Amazon Echo finally went on sale again. Not quite $100, but it was $150, so I decided to buy it. And since then, it's become one of the favorite things I bought last year. This past week, and the amazing thing about the Echo to me is that every week, I get an email from Amazon telling me, oh, these are new things the Echo can do, or we've enhanced this, or, you know, whatever. So this past week, two things. One they announced, one they didn't, and I just happened to notice. The first thing that they did announce, or the first thing is that was announced, is that the Echo can now read, as in text-to-speech, Kindle ebooks. So if you've ever bought ebooks for your Kindle device or Kindle app on your tablet or phone, it can read those out loud using text-to-speech, which is pretty cool. I tried it last night, and it's not bad. I mean, you know, it's not like having a professional actor/reader read it, but it's not bad. And, you know, maybe I'll get to some of those books that I bought but never actually read now.
Yeah.
The other thing I noticed that I didn't see in their announcement is that the Echo now announces the name of the device that is connecting or disconnecting from it using Bluetooth. So, you know, I often use the Echo with my phone to play a podcast while I'm, you know, rummaging around the house. And it always just went bing or, you know, something like that when it connected, disconnected. Now it actually looks at the name of the device from the device, says it out loud and says, now disconnecting, you know, Todd's iPhone from or, you know, Todd's iPad or whatever it is. From it.
You know, that would get very funny with the way I name my devices, because my servers are all named after
Star Trek.
Actually after Greek gods. But my devices that I take places with me are all just nondescript female names.
Ah.
And I do that mostly because if I'm in a coffee shop or I'm somewhere where there's public Wi-Fi, I figure nobody's going to think that, you know, Allie is that big guy in the corner or, you know, Melissa is that guy over there on a MacBook or something like that. So I do that for just kind of the fun of it as well. But that would mean that Alexa would probably have some very, you know, strange things to say about, you know, other women that are invading her space.
You know, one wonders if some people name their devices using swear words.
Well, yeah. Well, I think of, so Carrie's iPhone right now, and this is a Stargate reference, so we'll see if anyone listening will see where this reference comes from. Her iPhone is named Fat Anubis.
Okay.
Do you get that reference?
Yes. I'm a big Stargate fan.
Yeah, so based off of the, like, I think, what, two episodes where Fat Anubis appears? Yeah, we were joking one day, and I said, well, you need something that no one would know. So now I've broadcast it. I guess we have to change it. But, Fat Anubis.
Well, you know, I used to name servers after Star Trek Next Generation characters. So if those had, and of course servers don't have Bluetooth, but if I had named my devices, it would be now disconnecting from Picard, you know, now disconnecting from Troy. I like that. What is that? Is that your
This is
cover?
Since you mentioned Star Trek Next Generation, this is a messenger bag that you can get on ThinkGeek right now.
Wow.
That I just, it's a, yeah, Star Trek uniform messenger bag.
Yeah, so. Next Generation uniform, the red and black
of one. Course. And I actually, my in-laws got me a smaller one that's an original series messenger bag. So that's why I've been using it at work lately. And this is the bag that I intend to use when we travel and I need to take my full laptop and things like that. So
right.
I've decided to make, I guess, 2016 the year of geeking out on Star Trek. So
it's always a good year to do that.
It is. It always is.
And we have a new Star Trek movie coming out, what, this summer?
Yeah. I've been wearing my uniform hoodie, too, which is... also an awesome thing to wear. It's really funny. When you wear something that looks like a Next Generation Red Command uniform, right. It's a hoodie, people come up to you about a half hour after they've seen you and said, I just got what your hoodie was a reference to. And they're blown away by it, and they're so, you know, I've had people tell me that they're very jealous, and people have threatened to take it from me with bodily force. And I definitely recommend it.
Right. And of course, you're a pretty big guy, so taking it from your bodily force is probably
it's not
a good idea.
But it's kind of funny that, you know, I think I was at a football game a few months ago, the football game that I forgot we were podcasting, and blew you off for a football game. Or actually, it went long, there was, I think, a guy came up to me at one point and said, "My wife just wanted me to tell you that she loves your hoodie and that she wanted to steal it." Well. I'm glad she didn't come over here. I also could have, you know, gotten violent.
Okay, now the last item on our list is something you have. You're using.
I've been playing with quite a bit lately. So one of the things I've liked having on all of my devices for years and years is remote access capabilities, even for my home devices, because I want to get into my work computer. I want to get into my home computer while I'm at work, etc. And while I can usually open up like an SSH port or something like that, I've generally been using – I used LogMeIn for a long time before LogMeIn decided to make everything pay. And I started using TeamViewer after that. And TeamViewer is an awesome, awesome utility for people who are not using it for commercial use. It's free for personal use, mm-hmm. and I recommend it to a lot of my colleagues because – the university doesn't provide any way for us to get to our office computers when we're at home, and TeamViewer works very well. And I like TeamViewer, but I like using built-in things if I can. I don't always like to have an extra piece of software I'm dependent on. So this all gets around to an app that I've been using quite a bit called Screens. Just the word Screens. It's available for iOS and for macOS. It's a little pricey. But it's a VNC screen sharing app. So VNC is a protocol that's been around for a very long time that allows you to connect to the visual display on your device. So you can run it on Windows, Mac, Linux, whatever you want. Mac OS actually has a built-in VNC server that you can activate by going to the sharing pane in settings and choosing screen sharing. The only problem with VNC is that you have to open a port in order to get to it. If you're like me, you get a little paranoid about opening more ports than you have to. I open a port for SSH because I use that for command line. I don't really want to open another port for VNC. But the cool thing about Screens is that it has built-in support for what they call secure connections, which really just means that they tunnel your VNC connection over the SSH connection that you create first. So you open up one port that you might already even have open if you connect to your machines from work or from home, and you're able to get in. And if you are really stumped and you have, for example, a workplace that has a very restrictive firewall, mm-hmm. you can actually make use of what's called a reverse tunnel through SSH on your work computer. This is something I've talked about, and I think I might eventually do a blog post about it, to basically map your work computer to a public connection that you have access to, so maybe a virtual machine or your home machine or something like that, and then just connect using the native VNC protocol. So.
Yeah, this is all stuff that network administrators love.
Yeah, that's why I'm talking about it. I mean, it's just really cool that, and Screens has sync support, so yeah. If I add a profile on macOS, it syncs up to iOS, yeah. Syncs across all my iOS devices. So I just rebuilt one of my MacBooks over here. I reinstalled everything on it last night, and it's up and running in Screens now. I can connect to it with about two taps from any other device, and it's all secure, tunnels nicely. If you're on the local network, it can tell it, hey, if I'm on the local network, don't connect through SSH, just connect directly. So it won't randomly create new connections. So
yeah, you know, and all this isn't from the actual VNC Corp or whatever it's called. VNC itself is an open protocol, so that's not a problem. But you know, I found it interesting that even years ago, VNC always had paid versions. You know, mm-hmm. I think Real VNC or whatever it was. I think there were some free versions, but they became more and more. I can't think of the word I'm looking for. More and more company-like versus, you know, open source. But you know, I don't fault them for it. It's a good product, and it's very useful. And if it's something you need, it's worth $20 or $30.
Yeah, and so Screens is really just a viewer, but they've got a lot of nice options in there, and it works for any VNC server that you're connecting to. So there's a number of different VNC implementations out there. It should work with all of them, and it's just a pretty app. So if you're connecting, yeah, there's cheaper apps that will get the job done, but if you want something that's reliable, it doesn't crash, and it takes advantage of things like full screen support and macOS and all that, it's a nice app. It's a nice option.
Okay.
So before, it's $19.99 for iOS and $29.99 for macOS.
Okay. So before we close out podcast number, I just decided we're going to call this 145. But I have to ask, you know, I'm going to ask you periodically this question. Now that you've had your iPad Pro for several months, how are you feeling about it? Still very useful? Still kind of fits that niche you were hoping it would target?
Okay, so this is an interesting question, and it's a good week to ask me this because I did start teaching again this week. Here's what I have found that I think is where the iPad Pro is going to become niche-wise for me. Basically, when I am at meetings, I use it to type notes because mm-hmm. I can type notes on it faster than I can usually scribble even with the Apple Pencil, although I do like using the Apple Pencil. When I'm in front of students, if I actually downloaded an app this week that lets me project a virtual whiteboard on the iPad Pro. Mm-hmm. So I can pull up it just goes over a web page, an HTML5 web page with JavaScript. So any other device can connect to it on the local network and view the web page. So it's good for scrolling, those sorts of things. Where it doesn't work that well is presenting. The iPad Air 2 is still the best size for wandering around a room and advancing slides and that sort of thing. Looking up my notes, if it's a lot of notes, the iPad Pro works, but the iPad Air 2 is probably the better option for that. So I'm taking both the birds agree wholeheartedly with this. Yeah. Yeah. So I take every day to work the iPad Pro, so I have something to take notes and also to present information. So I was at a meeting yesterday where I had that, and someone said, oh, can you bring that up and show us, et cetera. And I take the iPad Air 2 with me as well for when I'm actually presenting in the classroom. So I take two iPads and use them kind of one as the notebook replacement and one as the device for presenting and wandering around the room. And, of course, to project, I have my iPhone connected to the instructor station up front. So,
you know,
everything comes from.
I haven't seen such a product, but you need an iPad holster, one on each side like an old gunslinger.
Don't tempt me, Todd. That would, you know. But here is my usage tip. If anyone's ever wondered this, it is possible if you use Keynote to have multiple remotes controlling the same Keynote presentation.
Okay.
which is kind of cool. If you and, say, a colleague are presenting something, you just need one person's device connected up, and then you can have multiple people controlling the show and pointing things out and advancing slides and all of that. And that also means you could have different views. So if you have two iOS devices hanging out with you like I do, actually I have three because I have the iPhone, you could have one that's showing your current slide and the next slide, and then another one that shows your current slide and the notes for that slide. And yeah, you can get very, very invested in kind of a full text setup with mobile devices.
Nice. Nice. Okay, so as I said, I finally decided this is going to be Mobile Views Podcast number 145, not 144 part 2. And John and I will return. Hopefully, we'll have a guest or two coming up in the next couple of podcasts, but we'll figure that out soon enough. Tadogasawara, John Westfall, we'll be back.